Good morning. The only argument worth having on the airwaves this week was around the tantalising idea of zero COVID.
The day-to-day is relatively normal here in New Zealand. The only kind of COVID restrictions we have are to wear masks on public transport, but everything else, you know, we can go to bars, restaurants, cafes, meet up with friends. We're going to a festival in a few weeks' time, going away next weekend. So, yeah, we feel just so lucky. It's almost like a alternate reality.
Aideen Stack in Auckland talking to Claire. So, could we be New Zealand? Well, for a whole host of reasons, the government says no. Claire spoke to Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on Wednesday and put precisely that to him.
Why is the government so dismissive of zero COVID?
So I don't think anyone is dismissive of it. I can tell you as Health Minister, I think the more ideas that are on the table, the better. I've met
but
with
I watched the... I watched the press conference yesterday, and I spoke to the Taoiseach on the television Monday night, and it's very much, it's not going to work. And, you know, I think the Taoiseach smiled and said, you can't seal the border. It's not going to happen. And then there's talk about, you know, you won't be able to go on holidays. You won't be able to have people home for Christmas. That's not what it's about. I think there's a misunderstanding around the potential reward here. Everybody knows we can't go on holidays, on foreign holidays this summer. I think people get that. The reward is about being able to see our parents in the summer. It's about being able to meet your friends for a cup of coffee or for something to eat. It's about living a normal life in Ireland. That's the reward that we see.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that we are seeing that you've properly considered it.
Well, I certainly have, and I've met some of the people who advocated for it, and we've shared ideas, and I think there's a lot of sense to a lot of what's being said, right? If you look at what we've just introduced, and you line it up side by side with the zero COVID list of border controls, there's really not that much difference anymore. The big issue Ireland has, the big challenge Ireland has, is travel north-south with Northern Ireland. The North and the UK government have ruled out any checks between Britain and Northern Ireland. So that would be a huge problem in a zero COVID strategy. And we're not going to seal the border around the six counties. That's not and has never been on the table.
Why?
And so,
why?
For important political reasons and
but this
and
is
national
I was saying
reasons,
this to Ian Paisley Jr. on Monday night. This is not it shouldn't be political. This is about people dying. This is about 5,000 people or more on this island dying, you know. And and there's talk about bubbling or having a two island policy with the UK. 100,000 deaths there. It's about protecting the citizens of this country. So to just say we're not going to seal the border for political reasons, you need to give us more than that.
Well, my view is that people living in Northern Ireland are Irish citizens. Many of them have Irish citizenship and Irish passports, and some choose not to. They choose to have British citizenship. But I certainly would not be standing over stopping Irish citizens or indeed anyone who lives in Northern Ireland from moving around this island.
But people listening to this, they can't travel 5K beyond their homes.
But while wrapping the country in cling film might be tempting, when Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was on the news at 1, he was anxious to stress that international travel wasn't really the main transmitter of COVID.
It's really important that we as a society don't see restrictions on international travel as a silver bullet here. Roughly 1,000 people are contracting COVID every day. The numbers of those who are getting COVID as a consequence of international travel is very, very small. Maybe as little as 1%, maybe less.
Nevertheless, the government decided to put in place mandatory hotel quarantine for 12 countries, starting with South Africa and Brazil. But opposition parties were pretty much united in their view that this was not enough, not by a long shot. Later on Wednesday's Drive Time, Tomás Ryan, Associate Professor in the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College, joined Sarah. And for him, a zero COVID strategy was not just feasible, it was essential.
We've heard really a whole range of reasons from the government at this point as to why zero COVID won't work. I mean, the border with Northern Ireland is one. Our situation in Europe, our connectivity, we're a small open economy, essential supplies, it's disproportionate. I mean, there's a list of reasons why we can't do it and should or shouldn't do it.
Well, that's all very wrong. The government strategy, they call it suppression. It's obviously not suppression. The government strategy is rolling lockdowns. It's going to fail again. We are going to be in rolling lockdowns for the rest of the year. They are not doing anything. They're sitting there and they're waiting for vaccines. And they say that people like me, they try and imply that I'm in the minority. The majority of the country have this opinion. Right now, the majority of the country know the government strategy has failed. People are waiting for a strategy. Mm. And when the fire brigade says that we have to live with our house being on fire, then you have to question whether they are the right fire brigade for this job.
Okay, but what about the genuine reasons then the government is giving? Like, for example, we've been told by the Taoiseach there this week that if we were to try and get the numbers as low as we need to get them, you know, under whatever 50 it might be, that it could take us months, that it took Melbourne three months, I think, to get to that.
No, that's a nonsense. You see, we're in a long lockdown anyway because of the decision to open up at Christmas. We can't get away from that. We're in a long lockdown now anyway. And we can get to single-digit cases. So the lockdown is already taken care of. We need mandatory hotel quarantine, and I'm glad to see that we have dissent in every government party about zero COVID and mandatory hotel quarantine. And the last thing we need is to better resource public health, because we can only test and trace when we do it very fast, in a very fast manner, and when we have a very small number of cases. And regarding the border, there are many ways of managing it. If we can't achieve an all-island approach through diplomacy and collaboration, which is, again, what most people want, north and south of the border. If we can't do that, we can at least engage in pragmatic border management.
Pragmatic border management, says Tomás Ryan. So what might that look like? In any event, NEFID says no. Here's Áine on Friday's Morning Ireland.
Yesterday evening, Professor Philip Nolan, who chairs NEFID's modelling advisory group, said aiming for zero COVID would be risky to try, as we're a leaky country. More realistic, he said, would be to get the level of infection down and keep it down.
We have to accept that in the circumstances of this country, no such system will be perfect and guarantee complete exclusion of any new disease or any new variant. And in that context, frankly, I go further than Doctor. I think it's an utterly false promise to say if we put certain things in place now, we can go to level zero or level one on the framework in a matter of weeks or months. That won't happen, and it would be an incredibly risky thing to do because of the fact that we will inevitably be a leaky country. We will inevitably get reintroduction of disease. That disease could easily be new variants. So I think a much more realistic strategy to say, let's get the level of disease down and then let's work to keep it there, gives us real strategic options between now and vaccination, as opposed to, and it's arguable, there are plenty of people that I respect that are advocating for this strategy, but I simply disagree with them. I think it's a false promise, and if the promise were brought to fruition, it would be a huge risk.
Philip Nolan, as heard on Morning Ireland yesterday. But leaky or no, might there be back-channel negotiations afoot? Back to Stephen Donnelly with Clare on Wednesday.
What we've got to do is we've got to have as close to an all-island strategy as possible. And one way to do that is a two-island strategy, right? So Matt Hancock, who's the UK health minister, and I have been talking, the Taoiseach's been talking with the Prime Minister, and there's been various back and forth to see, is there merit to as closely aligning the border control measures for the UK and for Ireland as possible, which deals with the challenge, which is free flow north, south and east, west from Northern Ireland.
So that's the plan, is it? A two island strategy? Because I'm asking you about a plan after March the 5th.
Yeah, so it's being explored.
Health Minister Stephen Donnelly with Clare on Wednesday. But would bubbling with our nearest neighbours be the worst notion? They do, after all, have lashings and lashings of vaccine. Because this week, so the vaccine manufacturer AstraZeneca announced they might be a little bit short. Difficulties in the supply chain and all that. Glitches. Well, according to the WHO's David Nabarro, who spoke to Clare on Monday, these things will happen.
Well, I think every country is trying to scale up vaccination, particularly to protect those most at risk. And whenever we hear of shortfalls in any company production, it's frustrating. But these shortfalls usually mean that there's some effort being made to improve the quality of production. Vaccine production is not straightforward. Sometimes you get batches that just are not good enough. So a shortfall usually has a good reason for it. And so whilst I understand people being disappointed, it's part of what happens when you're producing vaccines and everybody is rushing to get vaccine produced as quickly as possible. There will be breaks in supply. There will be uncertainties about particular vaccines. There'll be worries when you get two or three side effects reported in quick succession. This is the reality. We've all got to be ready for the fact that this won't be a perfect process. It'll have, frankly, snafus, and we have to live with that.
A very zen David Nabarro there. And yesterday afternoon, the European Medicines Agency did indeed approve use of the AstraZeneca vaccine. But might Boris have wiped Ursula's eye by getting the UK order in for the vaccine a whole 3 months ahead of the EU? Top of the queue, chaps and all that. Well, here's Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College, with Brian Dobson on Wednesday's News at One.
They've said that there have been glitches, but they're making the point, because the comparison has been made with output for the UK, that the UK contract was signed 3 months before the European vaccine deal. So in Europe, they're saying they're 3 months behind fixing those glitches. I mean, 3 months can be vital, can it, in this kind of situation?
Exactly. So the UK were ahead of Europe both in ordering their vaccine, but also in approving it. And Europe took a little bit longer. The EMA took longer than the MHRA to approve it. And clearly, you know, if a vaccine hasn't been approved, there's not much onus on the company to start production in case there's a glitch in the approval. So once it's approved, then they can, you know, full steam ahead in the production. Although it's unheard of, and this would never have happened in the past with other vaccines. You would never start massive production prior to getting approval. So all the companies have been doing some production, but very small amounts before they get approval. So Europe was behind the UK on this for sure when it comes to the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular.
Ooh, things not to say in Brussels.
In a strongly worded statement this afternoon, the EU Health Commissioner said that the third meeting with the company last night resulted again in insufficient explanations from the company. She added, "We reject the logic of first come, first served. That may work at the neighbourhood butchers, but not in contracts and not in our advance purchase agreements."
Ooh, not impressed at all. Meetings were called. Meetings were cancelled, or were they? Here's Shona Murray of Euronews on Wednesday's Drive Time.
It's getting pretty bitter and pretty heated because it started off today, Sarah, when the EU said that AstraZeneca had pulled out of a meeting today with the steering committee, the EU steering committee, and representative of the member states. That meeting will go ahead at around 6:30, but it'll only, according to EU sources, have one representative from AstraZeneca, and AstraZeneca had apparently told Brussels that it didn't have any good news for it. We've seen strong calls from the EU for AstraZeneca to get back to the table and to fulfil its obligations. I think a lot of people will have heard that interview in La Repubblica from AstraZeneca CEO, where he said, for example, that the contract between the EU and AstraZeneca was for AstraZeneca to do its best effort to fulfil its contract. Now, the EU has said today that that's legally and morally incorrect, and that the order itself was an advance purchase order, and the best effort related to the just creating the vaccine, because this contract was signed before the vaccine was actually developed. And the EU has said that they chose AstraZeneca because of its production capacity. And then I think important point as well that we heard in that interview with the head of AstraZeneca, he said, well, the UK signed its contract 3 months in advance. The EU refuted that today and said, well, hold on a minute, our contract is watertight. You never pointed to a first-come, first-served basis. And if you had, we would have had something to say about it then.
And our rollout is better than your rollout? Nah, 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 is not helping.
The relations between the EU and the UK are really at the lowest point. And I think, you know, from an EU's point of view, they look over at the UK government saying, we heard Boris Johnson saying it yesterday, that he spoke to AstraZeneca and Pfizer and that the UK will have their contracts fulfilled and they will get their vaccine doses. And then you hear some of the sort of jingoistic language from the UK saying, you know, we've done more vaccinations than, you know, one day that France has ever done, and so on. So I think that's not going down too well either.
On Thursday, Clare spoke to Conservative MP Andrew Bridgen. He's also a Brexiteer. You might hear that.
Research was carried out at Oxford University. This is a vaccine which is not for profit. It's effectively a charity at £3 a dose. Its efficacy has been proven, and it's very usable for developing parts of the world because it isn't required to be kept at minus 80. What you've actually got is conflict coming because the European Union has seriously mishandled the purchasing and ordering of vaccines. It placed a lot of hope and a lot of stock behind the two French vaccines, which have both failed in tests. It's been announced this week, and it's seeking to deflect responsibility for that mismanagement onto AstraZeneca in the UK.
But they paid hundreds of millions of euro, the EU did, to Oxford AstraZeneca to meet a certain schedule.
They did, but they ordered the vaccine 3 months after the UK ordered it, so they're behind us in the queue. They claim, I mean, spuriously, that the reason for the three-month delay is that the EU were looking to get better prices and better value for money for the remaining EU 27. Claire, that's ludicrous. When how are they going to get better value than it's not for profit? It's £3 a dose. So what were they messing about at? And then they insisted in the contract with AstraZeneca 3 months later that they wanted delivery of their vaccine at the same time as the UK, who'd ordered it 3 months before, and the production facility was being got ready in the UK. The EU vaccine from AstraZeneca was going to be manufactured in Belgium. Obviously, they haven't had time to get the facility ready. And AstraZeneca warned the EU and said, we can't sign a contract guaranteeing you supply at this stage because of the delay. So it'll be best endeavours. We'll try our very best.
And it would turn out to be all about the interpretation of that phrase, best efforts. Yesterday, the EU published the contract, albeit with bits redacted. And while the clauses and subclauses of contract law is no doubt a riveting listen, we'll keep this brief. Here's the view of European law expert Professor Gavin Barrett of UCD on yesterday's News at One.
The term best reasonable efforts does occur quite a number of times in the contract, Brian, it's referred to, I think, 15 times in the redacted contract. But as to whether the best reasonable efforts clauses back up what Pascal Soriot, the chief executive officer of AstraZeneca, has claimed for it is another question. He made extraordinarily wide claims in relation to this, that the AstraZeneca would be entitled to put the European Union to the back of a previously unmentioned queue, and that's certainly not part of any contract law that I'm familiar with, that you can get out of contractual obligations simply because you've agreed another contract with somebody else. The idea that you could provide the United Kingdom with all of its vaccination requirements but not provide the European Union with any of its, or at least only 40% of its, doesn't seem to me on an initial reading to be backed up.
But whatever way you tussle it, there will be a shortfall, which in turn will affect our vaccine rollout. And how are we doing so far? Well, figures from Thursday say that here in Ireland, we've vaccinated 161,500 people. Our UK neighbours, 7.45 million. Now we're clearly Europeans, go Europe. But are we coming round to that notion of the two-island bubble? We are so very close to Britain. That old Brexit kerfuffle got a bit out of hand. 800 years bygones. Surely we could make a tiny wee bubble. She'd hardly know we're there, just for walks and things. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Former President Mary Robinson might just have been one of the few optimistic voices on the radio this week. She was feeling hopeful for the planet against the backdrop of renewed climate emergency measures adopted by US President Joe Biden. And she was chatting to Anya on Morning Ireland.
One lesson that we've learned throughout this pandemic, throughout this really tough past year, is that we're only as strong, we're only as well or as healthy as the weakest or sickest of us. That's a lesson that applies to global warming. Do you think the penny has dropped at all politically there?
I think you're right that we can learn very important lessons from COVID. We can learn that collective human behaviour matters, because that's what's keeping us from the virus in the absence of the vaccine up to now, or the vaccine just coming on board. We have to think about that in the future, about consumption, about waste, about plastics, about the fact that we waste a third of the world's food. You know, we have to have a circular economy and move in a different direction. Secondly, government matters. Thirdly, science matters. And fourthly, and this is important, compassion matters. You know, we're all set back and we're seeing a lot of human kindness and neighbourliness in every country. And there wasn't the empathy before for those who are suffering more. I think we're a bit more open to the kind of solidarity that will be needed so that developing countries get the investment so that they can move to clean energy because they got the investment and the technology and the training. They won't, otherwise, they won't be able to do it, and they'll use up the carbon budget, which will hurt them first, but it'll hurt everybody. We won't have a proper future. You know, COVID has helped. I have said a few times that I was more depressed in January last year than I am now, because January last year, we were moving towards a COP in November of 2020, and I saw no sign of the kind of ambition that would be needed. Now I'm seeing it. And most of all, in what President Biden said yesterday.
That's a little bit of good news. And I would hazard that Mary Robinson would have been silently cheering if she was listening to Liveline on Tuesday. Now, they kicked off with a spat about the leaving up of Christmas lights. Cheery, hopeful versus wasteful and kind of try hard. Now, truth be told, as Liveline scraps go, this was kind of low level. But then Andy from Leitrim phoned in.
I believe none of us have the right to waste power. It's a waste of energy. God's given energy that we have only the right and the duty only to use the energy that we need. We should be thinking about the generations that's going to come after us, that we waste as little as possible.
Okay, and you're saying we should be thinking...
Since COVID came in, climate change seems to have gone out the window. We seem to have forgotten about climate change.
And then Joe asked this.
And Andy, did you put up Christmas lights yourself?
No, I don't, no, because I live on my own. And
Andy.
There's not... I put one candle in the window to welcome Jesus. That's all I did. You'll never find a light on in my house that's not needed.
Oh.
I don't waste energy.
And it's about,
not the money. Yeah. I probably could afford more to use or to leave a light on. You know what I mean? But I won't do it. I'm just doing the right thing. And the same with COVID. I hear people talking that COVID is hard on people. Maybe it is. I don't know. But I don't find it hard. And I'm sticking to all the rules. I haven't been in the house since last March. I haven't been to any. And I don't see anyone from one end of the week to the next, you know. But I look on that as a blessing in some ways, because I'm able to keep myself safe. You understand?
Yeah,
I don't look at it as being hard.
And Andy, did you see anyone on Christmas Day?
No, I was on my own on Christmas Day, and I've no problem with that.
Have you a little dog?
No, that's a long story. Oh. I had a dog and he died. He died from cancer. And I did everything to try and save her. People don't understand how attached you can become to an animal. You know, I have a cat now at the moment, and she basically talks to me. You mightn't believe that. She has only three legs, you know. And but no, I said I'd never have another dog, even though I'm awful fond of animals, but I'd never have another dog, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I could never replace the dog that I had, you know.
Andy on Liveline. The stimulation and sometimes the strangeness of visiting other countries was recalled by Mary Dowie on Sunday Miscellany, and in particular a journey to Japan in 1984.
We started in Tokyo, where a crucial initial task was to recognise the two Japanese characters meaning exit. Otherwise, whole days might have been lost in the sprawling maze of the subway. I interviewed an 89-year-old actor, so talented that he had attained the rank of important intangible cultural asset. Then it was time to leave the beaten track and drive north to Tohoku, a region of paddy fields ringed by snow-capped mountains. Because no road signs were in English, the first task each day was to spread a map out on the car bonnet and transcribe the names of towns on the itinerary into attempted Japanese. "Next town, please," the driver would ask. The navigator shouted descriptions of the first few characters. "Tree, window with curtains, pagoda roof. There was only one wrong turn. We slept on tatami mats in ryokans, traditional inns with communal baths so hot that your body felt more fully poached than the fish in the miso broth served at dinner. One evening, while we were eating, a young woman appeared. The innkeeper had asked the only English speaker in town to drop by and see if we needed anything. The next morning, two middle-aged men approached me in the hallway. They had never seen fair hair before and wanted to touch mine.
From Sunday Miscellany. But if that's whetted your appetite for a bit of the exotic, yeah, no, because the edges of your 5K will have to do for a while more. We have another 6 weeks of lockdown ahead of us. And at this stage, according to the consumer data, personal hygiene is taking something of a hit. Here's Fran McNulty on the News at One.
Boots, which has a chain of shops right across the country, said they've seen a significant decrease in the sale of men's razors, also in the sale of men's deodorant. There's a reported fall. Shampoo, Brian, sales are down because people aren't at work every day. They're not out and about.
Smelly, greasy and hairy, and who could blame us? But this next bit was quite interesting on all kinds of levels.
Pharmacies in particular, Brian, have seen some of the most kind of surprising changes. A 50% decrease in antibiotic use at Mars Pharmacy Group. They've shops all across Dublin and an online website as well. Antibiotics down 50%. 20% decrease in over-the-counter medicines for coughs and colds. A surprising one, or maybe not surprising, a 40% decrease in medicines which are prescribed for sexually transmitted diseases. But a real indication of how people are struggling, a 30% increase in antidepressant, anti-anxiety medicines and sleeping tablets as well. So we're seeing those kind of real impacts on people's lives.
Ooh, that's not what you want to hear. But there were strategies aplenty on the radio again this week to help get us through this without going in on ourselves entirely. Child psychologist David Coleman was on with Claire and responded to a parent who'd emailed in about her 15-year-old son who was feeling very anxious.
Sometimes it's really helpful for young people when we can explain to them the nature of anxiety. And so anxiety is critically useful to all of us. If we didn't have the capacity to become anxious, then we could end up in some really dangerous situations. So anxiety is a really functional, useful thing for humans to have. And I think sometimes when children and teenagers realise that, it makes a difference for them, and it may well make a difference for this young lad, because I think sometimes we hear people saying, you know, I have anxiety, as if it's almost like this thing that got given to people, you know. And sometimes if we think about it that more, I feel anxious, it helps to explain again just that context, that, you know, the current circumstances, the level of uncertainty that's out there for us. So even if he's not worried about his actual junior cert, you know, there's so much other change that has gone on for this young lad, no more than for his family, that with that level of uncertainty, anxiety is almost to be expected. I mean, I can't imagine there are too many people in Ireland who haven't experienced some level of anxiety or some kind of worry about something that has changed because of coronavirus. So the anxiety itself is quite natural, quite normal. And maybe if he understood that, then that would also allow him to be a little bit more open with some of the tools like the breathing, or, you know, there's lots of other mindfulness techniques or meditative techniques that can be really helpful in terms of that thinking process where a child feels that they're getting these bad thoughts. And so that will allow them again just to move away from the negative thinking and hopefully move towards something a little bit more positive.
And Ryan spoke to clinical psychologist Dr. Keith Gaynor, and he talked about resilience, creativity, community and solidarity as being key elements to help us cope at this time. However, this texter wasn't feeling it.
Yeah, a text from Kathleen in Galway says, regarding lockdown, I've spent the last few days in tears in my flat. I stopped at the checkpoint going to the local shop. Stopped again going to the dentist. We all know people back from sun holidays in our supermarket and UK registered cars all over Christmas without isolating. We're the soft targets. That's why it's more difficult. Tell Keith, I'm not hopeful.
Yeah, and I think that this is the reason for the piece, because I think the majority of people that I'd ask would say they're not hopeful.
Yeah.
But I think hope, we have to go and have to work and find it. It won't come to us. And the things like the guard, the checkpoints and that can be really dispiriting. You know, here we are again. But actually digging down and trying to find, okay, what is it in here that I can find hope? And I'd wonder, within that 5K, is there something that might be hopeful for that lady? Mm. Is there something? Where's the daffodil in there? Yeah, that's good.
You know,
and I think that all those things happen to Christmas and they're very dispiriting. But you will have noticed at Christmas, so many acts of solidarity. So much good was happening as well.
Yeah.
And we have to, that you know, that isn't the first thing that comes to mind. We have to seek it out. But when you do it, that's where you'll find feelings of hope.
And Claire asked this of behavioural economist Pete Lunn.
So bottom line then, Pete, you think we have the resilience to get through the next 6 weeks?
Everything I've seen in the data suggests that, yes, we do. But, you know, we've never been here before. You know, so I'm guessing based on what I can see in that data and what I can see from the previous waves that we've coped with. But as I said, really positive feedback to people, I think, is really important. We are getting on top of this and we're doing it because we're doing well with our behaviour. So we have to keep going.
I can't go on. I'll go on, bringing us neatly and, yes, pretentiously to Samuel Beckett. Oh, no muck here on Playback. Siobhan McSweeney of Derry Girls fame is playing Winnie in Happy Days, or as Sean Rocks on Arena so deftly put it.
If Beckett did nuns, it'd be Sister Michael.
As it happens, Sister Michael was inclined to agree.
She is quite the character. She doesn't shut up at all. She doesn't shut up at all, which is great for a woman who's well able to learn lines. Yes, me, myself and I, the three of us chatting away inanely on top of a mound buried up to my waist.
But she also thought there was something about the character and predicament of Winnie that resonated with today.
Of course, you can always say that every play speaks to right now. That's of course, what you're going to say for marketing purposes, aren't you?
Yeah.
But this actually does, you know. You're talking about a woman who's talking her way out of despair, who's talking her way to avoid the reality of what's going on around her. The earth is moving up her. The earth is beginning to swallow her. She's beginning to lose herself in whatever shape or form you imagine that to be. And she is trying to cling on, as you said, the eternal optimist. She's trying to cling on. And I think, you know, for obvious reasons, we can really identify with that at the moment. And the reason why we keep talking and the reason why we keep going, you know, if it's one person is enough.
Yeah.
You don't need a room full of people. You just need one person. And I think there's also something really interesting about doing it to an empty theatre. There are echoes and ghosts there that can come back to us. And there's also the fact that you will be watching it. I hope you specifically, Sean, will be watching it through a screen. You know, that is very much how we have been living this last while as well. But of course, there are very contemporary and, you know, obvious correlations with the moment. But the fact of the matter is that this is an extraordinary play at any time.
Siobhan McSweeney on Beckett's Happy Days as heard on Arena. However, if your tastes run more to heaving bosoms, tight breeches and aristocracy running amok in Regency London, Bridgerton on Netflix might be more your thing. It stars Waterford's Jamie Beamish, who plays the dastardly Nigel Burbrook. He spoke to Ryan on Friday and this is how he explained the programme's massive appeal.
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, obviously, like you say, it is the pandemic. And also, you know, you're looking at all these kind of people in beautiful costumes, beautiful locations, and they're at these balls. It's the social season. And we're in a situation now where we can't have social season. You know, we're not able to do all that. So there's great escapism in looking at that. You know, it's like watching a box of Quality Street and kind of all your favourite sweets at the same time.
Yes.
And then also, what they're really clever with and is that, you know, bringing in kind of modern elements to something that seems very far away. So you've got the diversity of the cast is a real huge thing.
Yes.
You know, and then also, you know, kind of feminist elements to it as well. Mm. You always talk about like the male gaze, but actually in Bridgerton, when you watch it, it's the female gaze. You don't necessarily have these longing kind of shots on, you know, the female body. It's actually on the male body. Reggae Jean Page, who plays the Duke, I mean, I know him, I've worked with him, he bet me up on set, you know, in a scene. But I feel after watching Bridgerton, I really know him, you know.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
It's that kind of switch in things. And I think people kind of are really getting into that, and the music even.
Yeah, definitely the music. But Ryan asked him how his health was, because Jamie had been quite ill.
Yeah, 11 years ago,
yeah.
While I was doing Aikino at the Olympia, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a cancer of the lymphatic system. And at the time, I went through, about 6 months of chemotherapy at University Hospital Waterford. And then I relapsed, unfortunately, then about 2 years later. I was in a play at the National Theatre in London, and I found that it had relapsed. So I went back into chemotherapy and then eventually had a stem cell transplant in St. James's. In Dublin,
And so now?
And now, fine, I've been in remission since 2009, thank God, and all good. And it's, with the success of Bridgerton, it's been nice. I've been getting lots of messages from people I haven't heard from in a long time, which is really cool. But one of the best ones I got was from my main chemo nurse from University Hospital Waterford, Sam Finn. And out of nowhere, I hadn't spoken to her in years, and she sent me a message on Facebook to say, I'm watching Bridgerton and I see you. On it and doing great, and I'm really delighted. And that was magic, the kind of thing, There she's watching that, and she saw me at my sickest and my worst. And it's nice for her to be able to see that, because she's, part of the reason I'm still here, to be honest.
Isn't it amazing? Like, I know, I just feel people feel such a connection with the staff in hospitals, whether it's the porter or the people serving the food or the cleaners or the nurses, the doctors or receptionists who are such an important part in their lives that they never kind of forget each other, strangely.
No. I mean, and they're the magicians. Like, they're amazing, amazing people. I only dress up for a living. You know what I mean? You kind of, what they do every day is unbelievable. I think, and you're right. You do, that relationship keeps going. It doesn't go away, because it's a very specific part and an important part of your life when things like that happen.
Jamie Beamish with Ryan on Friday. Meanwhile, Ray Darcy was back in the kitchen, and he was joined by Emer McLysett, who talked about the singular joys of cooking for one.
And people who live on their own give out about cooking, because is it worth the effort?
Yeah, there's a couple of different strands. So it's like, is it worth the effort? How long is that going to sit in the fridge before it goes off and I have to try and use it? Like, a bag of carrots to me is just an instant panic. I'm like, well, we're going to use them all up. What are we going to put them in? And then if you cook something that's meant for four people, are you eating it for 4 days? Are you trying to put it in the freezer? It's a nightmare. Like, another thing, when you live on your own, you're only cooking for yourself. You're like, what's the point in spending 4 hours slow cooking something when it's just me who's going to sit down and go, well, isn't this nice, Lemur? Yes, it is. But I decided I was going to do that, and it turns out it's worth the effort. Like, it really is worth the effort. I send the pictures to Sarah and she goes, that looks lovely. So,
so the 4 hours in question was spent on a ragu.
Yeah, simple ragu. Yeah. And it was stunning.
Yeah. You see, it's worth the effort.
Yeah, and then I bought like the not cheapest pasta. Yes. In Tesco, like, I bought the one that's in the blue bag, not the one that's in the green bag.
That.
Like,
I'm going to take that away as well. The not cheapest.
I was like, you're worth it, Emer.
Yeah.
And this is what Quiz of the Day contestant Valerie was doing for fun on her day off, no less.
Well, I was very proactive today. I alphabetized all my herbs and spices, and that's how boring my life is at the moment.
I
think that my kitchen presses, and I'm really proud of them. And my kids are listening. If they mess them up, they're in big trouble.
You alphabetized. Is that even a word?
I don't know, but in my house it is, right?
Alphabetized.
I put my herbs and spices in alphabetical order.
I'm just trying to think what's the first one? Cinnamon.
No, there's basil before cinnamon.
Basil's before cinnamon, you're right, yes.
Yeah.
Basil before cinnamon, right. It's a good crack to do that in your head. No, maybe not, yeah. And there's paprika and smoked paprika. Do you put those together?
No, they're not together. They're separate, yeah.
Okay, right. Mm. Oregano, onion, salt. There's a few Fs. What's that? Fenugreek, is it? What's the name of that one?
Fenugreek. Yeah. I think I've only won F. I think I only have that. You're going to make me go over and look at the press now. Don't make me do that.
Right, the first one and the last one. Fair enough. Basil is the first. And what's the last one then?
The last one is turmeric.
Turmeric, right. Okay, yeah. Okay.
No shame in a well-organised spice rack, but is this what it's come to? Existential crisis. On Study Hub, they were trying to learn things. In this case, just understanding the question for the French oral exam. Here's Nick Grease with Evelyn O'Rourke.
What I usually say to the students is that learn in advance a question that relates to
Mr. Examiner, could you rephrase the question? Okay, or you can start that way.
So practice a question that says, please, do you mind explaining that? Or, you know, so have that ready to go.
Exactly. The first thing, if you misunderstand, if you have not heard it, ask him to repeat it. If you still don't understand the keyword, then ask him, could you give me details on that? Because I'm going to change the word, you know. You're going to change the word and then you might understand it. And then you can actually answer.
Or take a listen to Fionnuala, who was on with Ray for the quiz of the day. She gave a veritable masterclass in the art of not understanding the question.
Now, Fionnuala, on this day in 1926, John Logie Baird gave the first public demonstration of television in his laboratory. In which country of the United Kingdom was John Logie Baird born?
In which county of the United Kingdom, Ray?
No, in which country?
Of
the United Kingdom. So we're talking England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland.
Oh, right. I see. I was thinking, what country is it?
Yes.
Sorry. Very slow there. What's the name again?
John Logie Baird. He invented the television.
UK.
No, that's... So, in which country?
Yeah. Yeah.
In the UK, was he born?
Wales.
Say again?
Wales.
No, he was born in Scotland. Okay, so he finally got to... That was lost in translation there. Sorry
that
about that.
That was a bad question. Yes, okay, right.
Oh, they just didn't suit you. Well, that is almost it for this week's playback. But in case you're wondering,
is it la COVID or le COVID? Can you help us on that one? Is it la pandemic or le pandemic?
Alors, c'est la pandémie, and there's no C, Evelyn. So it's la pandémie for the pandemic, and it's le COVID because it's a virus, which is un virus, and it's masculine.
Almost sounds sexy. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.